Chapter 11 records for us the details of specific battles and references also some action that we're going to find a more detailed account of a little later. For example, in verse 21, there's a reference there to the battle against the Anakim in Hebron. And then we have more details of that in chapter 14, where Caleb goes and takes Hebron for his possession. But in chapter 11, we have our attention primarily drawn to the battle with the alliance headed by Jabin, king of Hazor, and then the follow-up operations against the various cities of those kings that were part of that alliance. Then in chapter 12, we have a review of the campaign of warfare to date by Israel, starting right back in the last years of Moses' life. Chapter 12 gives us a very quick review of the battle with Sihon and Og on the east side of Jordan and how that territory was settled by the 2.5 tribes that got their inheritance in that part of Canaan. And then we have a list of 31 kings that Joshua conquered in his campaign that has now come to an end. This really chronicles the end of a chapter as far as the campaign of Israel in Canaan is concerned. We read at the end of verse 23 that the land rested from war. So there is the ending of a chapter of that campaign at this point. And I want us especially to look at the verses 18, 19, and 20. They're key verses in this chapter, and indeed in the understanding of the warfare that went on and on and on in the land of Canaan. Joshua made war a long time with those kings. There was not a city that made peace with the children of Israel, save the Hivites, the inhabitants of Gibeah, and all other they took in battle, for it was of the Lord to harden their hearts, that they should come against Israel in battle, and that he might destroy them utterly, and that they might have no favor, but that he might destroy them as the Lord commanded Moses. Just before the chapter closes, if you like, on this section of Israel's campaign to possess Canaan, there is this key statement made that gives us an important insight into the whole of the warfare that was fought at that time, and indeed gives us an insight into the spiritual equivalent warfare that God's people are still called to be good soldiers of Jesus Christ. For God's people to possess their possessions, whether it was in Canaan or whether in terms of our spiritual inheritance in Christ in this present life, there is a battle to be fought, and we have some important insights given to us here about the nature of that battle and why it is necessary in these words that are recorded in this text, verses 18 through to 20. The first thing I want you to notice here is the inveterate opposition of the enemies of God's people. The inveterate opposition that they faced. We have in this chapter another factual account of the opposition that Israel faced at this point in their campaign to possess Canaan. The opening verses of the chapter describe for us the history of how there was this alliance that comes together, headed by Jabin, the king of Hazor. We're told in verse 10 that Hazor was the head of all those kingdoms. You have very dominant military and political figure here in this King Jabin and his city in Hazor. Indeed, he would appear to have established something of a dynasty, because even when we get a little later to the book of Judges in chapter 4 and 5 there, and the battle between Barak and Deborah and another Jabin, king of Hazor, there obviously is a strong hold here of enemy power and opposition to God's people. But there is another alliance formed here. In the wake of the victories of chapter 10, where a different alliance of kings in another area of the country had been formed, had come together, and Joshua and Israel had defeated them, we read that when they had heard those things, now here is a strange thing, that the report of the annihilation of that previous alliance, as it's recorded there in chapter 10, an alliance headed up by Adonizedek, the king of Jerusalem, when they heard of the destruction of that army, there rises in the hearts of Jabin and his associates here a determination, well, we've got to get a new army. We have to form a bigger army. And there is this, I suppose we can say it's a strange thing, that the only lesson they learned from the defeat of the previous alliance was that they needed to form a new alliance. And so Jabin, along with 10 other named parties here, some of them plural, it's not that there's just 10 kings, but some of them plural. There's the kings that were on the north of the mountains, for example, in verse 2. We count that as one party. And then there's the reference to the Canaanite and the Amorite and the Hittite and the Perizzite. So there may have, well, have been multiple kings and cities represented there in those ethnic identifiers that are used. But Jabin and 10 other distinct groups are referred to here. So a very substantial alliance. Now we're in a different part of the country at this point. You will find there a reference to Chinneroth in the verse 2. You may recognize that as one of the biblical names of the Sea of Galilee. So we're up in that northern part of the territory of Canaan. So we have a different region in view. Right across the north, from the northwest, right over through to the northeast, the whole northern section of the territory of Canaan. And a great army gathered together now, we read here, and their united purpose is given us in the final words of verse 5, to fight against Israel. That was the only thing they had in mind. All of them, whatever their ethnic and cultural differences may have been, and there would have been all kinds of squabbles and fights going on routinely among themselves, but now they're unified to fight against Israel, their common enemy. And this demonstrates the inveterate opposition of the enemies of God's people. That despite what they had to distinguish them one from the other, they have this in common. They're prepared to form an alliance in opposition to God's people. And in spite of the very recent defeat of an alliance of enemies in a different part of the country, they're still going to rise up and fight God's people. Now, as I read this, surely we are intrigued by a simple question. Why? Why would they do it? What is it that prompted them to fight against Israel? What is it that prompts sinners today and wicked men to stand up in defiance of God and fight tooth and nail, perhaps not in a military sense always, but fighting tooth and nail against divine truth, biblical revelation, the principles of biblical Christianity? They're hated and despised and opposed implacably and bitterly by the enemies of God. Why? Why do these Canaanite tribes insist on opposing the people of God when the evidence was all against them being successful in that opposition? Why do the enemies of the gospel persist on such a self-destructive course today? Well, that's where we come to verse 20 of this passage. The inveterate opposition of the enemies of God and His people is analyzed here in verse 20. It was of the Lord to harden their hearts, that they should come against Israel in battle, that He might destroy them utterly, and that they might have no favor, but that He might destroy them as the Lord commanded Moses. Now, when we look at verse 20, there are some hard statements here. There are some hard things, but they need to be acknowledged and recognized. The first thing in understanding the opposition of the enemy against God's people, the first thing to recognize is that the opposition that God's people face from their enemies is according to the divine purpose. God is in charge here. I know that some have a misguided view of the sovereignty of God, as if God's sovereign purposes somehow fail to take account of the actions of His enemies. That somehow He merely puts up with those things rather than sovereignly ordaining and overruling those things. But here we have a very strong statement that needs to be taken on board. It was of the Lord to harden their hearts that they should come against Israel in battle. Now, what does that mean? Simply and practically, it means that every time an enemy like Jabin and Adonizedek and any of the others that stood up against Israel, every time that enemy stood up and opposed God's people, God was in it. God was overruling it. That man, that king, that city stood up to defy God in the sovereign purpose of God Himself. This was not something happening outside God's control. He was in control. It was part of His purpose. All this is of the Lord. The words could not be clearer. It was of the Lord. He was in it. He was behind it. He was directing it. He was working it. You know, there is a comfort in this for God's people. Battle weary, battle scarred, fearful in the battle that God has called us to. Let us ever remember, God is in charge. That when the enemy comes against us, and the enemy says hard and bitter things, and presses us sore, and inflicts wounds upon us in the spiritual sense, let us remember, that's the Lord's work. So much so that the psalmist on one occasion, when speaking of his enemies that were ranged against him, spoke of that enemy as thy sword. The Lord was at work. He could see the Lord's hand in these things. Do we have to see the devil at work? Of course we do. But the devil is just the servant of God. The devil is the servant of God's sovereign purpose. And sometimes we are guilty of only seeing the devil and only seeing the purposes of wicked men. We need to lift our eyes higher, and it will be for our comfort to understand that the opposition is orchestrated by the Lord. He is the one at work here. Now that immediately, for the instructed believer, puts a new face on the opposition. It immediately changes our perspective, because if this is the work of God, if God is behind all of this, then it's for my good. I can rest in His purpose. I know His purpose is going to work together for good and for my good and for His glory. In Proverbs chapter 16, let me just show you a couple of the biblical statements of this truth. Proverbs chapter 16, and it's the verse 4 that we want in that chapter. Proverbs 16, the verse 4, the Lord hath made all things for himself. Yea, even the wicked for the day of evil. The wicked in all of their wickedness. Part of the sovereign, inscrutable purposes of God. Can I understand all of the ins and outs of that particular statement? No, I can't. But it nevertheless is a statement that must be believed and accepted at face value. An even clearer statement is found in Paul writing in Romans chapter 9 and giving us an exposition of the great doctrine of sovereign election to salvation. In Romans chapter 9 and the verse 15, he saith to Moses, I will have mercy on whom I will have mercy, and I will have compassion on whom I will have compassion. So then it is not of him that willeth, nor of him that runneth, but of God that showeth mercy. For the scripture saith unto Pharaoh, and he's quoting here from the book of Exodus, Moses speaking to Pharaoh. And here are the direct words of God quoted. Even for this same purpose have I raised thee up, that I might show my power in thee, that my name might be declared throughout all the earth. Even when Pharaoh was acting with the vicious hostility that he showed against Israel in Egypt, massacring the little ones, bringing the adults into bondage, and persecuting them so severely. God raised them up. God raised Pharaoh up to that position to do what he did. Therefore hath he mercy on whom he will have mercy, and whom he will he hardeneth. Thou wilt say then unto me, why doth he yet find fault? For who hath resisted his will? Nay, but O man, who art thou that repliest against God? Shall the thing formed say to him that formed it, why hast thou made me thus? Hath not the potter power over the clay, of the same lump to make one vessel unto honor, and another unto dishonor? In one sense, man is just like a piece of clay in the hand of God to make of him whatever God purposes. Now, God's purposes, in a strange and mysterious fashion, are never apart from the responsibility of the man, because man is more than a lump of clay. Man has been given a will. Man has been given responsibility, and he will be held accountable for his actions. But in one sense, all men are just like clay in the hands of God to do with them as he pleases. What if God, willing to show his wrath and to make his power known, endured with much long suffering the vessels of wrath fitted to destruction, and that he might make known the riches of his glory on the vessels of mercy which he had afore prepared unto glory? In these verses, there is an emphasis upon the sovereign purpose of God to raise up, to put down, to save, to reject, to make a Pharaoh, to raise him up, to harden him, to use him, to persecute his people, and then to destroy him. The purpose of God was at work in this. All of this is of the Lord. When this great alliance forms against Israel, when the enemies of God come against his people today, in whatever shape or form they appear, we need to say, this is of the Lord. We need to recognize that. The situation has not got out of control. This is of the Lord. He is as much in control now as he ever was. It's according to the divine purpose. But notice something else here. It was of the Lord to harden their hearts that they should come against Israel in battle. Now what's that saying? that God hardened the hearts of these men so that they opposed Israel. That's why they didn't learn from the previous defeats. Israel hadn't lost a battle yet, apart from that hesitation at the city of Ai. They hadn't lost. But here are men who, in spite of the obvious, are resolute in their determination to defy God and His people. Why? Because God hardened their hearts. Now, what does that mean? It's one of those expressions in Scripture that you have to think about and have to be careful how you explain. What does it mean for God to harden a man's heart? Well, men's hearts grow hard because of their sinful defiance of God. It is the working of sin that hardens the heart of man. It is the process of sin. You might be familiar with some of the compounds that may be used as adhesives or repair pastes of one kind or another that involve the mixing of one compound and a hardener. And there's a certain period of time where it's flexible and you can work with it, do what you need to do, and then it's hard. There's a process at work. Now, there's a process at work in the sinner. A hardening process that is the natural consequence of sin. But you see, for a time, that hardening process may be delayed because of the influences of divine grace and mercy. And so we read of God in Romans 9, showing mercy and long-suffering even with the wicked. We read even of these Amorites in the land of Canaan. A way back, we've looked at it several times already. In Genesis 15, God said centuries before, almost five centuries ago now, the cup of the Amorites is not yet full. I'm going to put up with them. I'm going to bear with them. Well, the hardening process was already at work, but it hadn't reached its full defiance of God, and it wouldn't do so for another 500 years. But now, to use other scriptural terminology that really explains this and is parallel of it, God gave them up to their sin. Now, that's what we read in Romans 1, is it not? We read there of that prolonged exposition and that epistle of the depravity of the human heart, and Paul is establishing the case for the legitimacy of divine justice in executing punishment upon sin. That's a part of the message of the gospel, Romans 1:18, the revelation of the wrath of God against the ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who hold the truth, or who resist the truth, who fight the truth, who wrestle against it in unrighteousness. And why is that righteous execution of wrath just and proper and fitting? And Paul goes into a lengthy argument. God has revealed Himself to them, even in the creation. He may be known, His eternal power, His Godhead. These things are clearly seen in the creation. But men, professing themselves to be wise, became fools. They turned from the revelation of God. They turned to idolatry. They turned to their wicked lusts. And what happened? God gave them up to uncleanness. That's the hardening process. For a time, the working of common grace had restrained sin and wickedness in their hearts, but as God withdraws, man becomes more defiant. That's the hardening process. That's what the Bible means when it speaks of God hardening the heart. It's not that He originates the hardness. No, He simply steps back, He withdraws, He gives that sinner up to his ways, and that sinner becomes hard. God had shown mercy even to the Amorites in restraining their sin for a period of time, but they fought God. They resisted God. They plunged headlong into a career of filthiness and idolatry. And God, there came a point where God gave them up. And that's what's happening here. God hardened their hearts. It's a sad day in the experience of any sinner when he becomes a militant foe of God's people. When Jabin the king of Hazor stood up and said, I'm against God, I'm against Israel, and they gathered an alliance, and we're going to take a stand against them, and we're going to fight them. That was a sad day. Because God had given that man up to destruction. He was standing up to be cut down. Oh, it's a tragedy. And we should ever remember this and I know it's a hard thing to remember whenever you're the object of the enemy's attack. But if we remember this truth, we will pity the enemy. We will pity those who fight against the cause of Christ. They are to be pitied. For when a man becomes a militant, implacable, inveterate foe of God and his cause, God has given him up. Not only was this of the Lord, and the fact we read here that God hardened their hearts that they should come against Israel, but he does this in order to execute justice upon the sin of those who defy him. Time for justice had come, that he might destroy them utterly. That's the sovereign purpose that should work here. God gives man up to the wicked hardness of their heart. They stand up as an inveterate enemy of the gospel and of Christ and of his people, and it is that they might be destroyed. God had patiently allowed the cup of wrath to fill up for the Amorites. Century after century they had added to their sin and their wickedness and their rebellion against God as a society, and now the time had come for them to drink that cup of wrath. This is the explanation for the opposition that God's people face here. But I want us to notice something else, the victory that is promised and obtained by God's people. In verse 6 there is a promise made. The Lord said to Joshua, be not afraid because of them. For tomorrow about this time will I deliver them up all slain before Israel. Thou shalt hough their horses and burn their chariots with fire. A new battle. In fact, I think it's fair to say the biggest challenge that they have faced to date, the biggest alliance of enemies, a ferocious power up here in the north, Jabin, the king of Hazor. We have in verse 4 a reference to the fact that there were as many as the sand that is upon the seashore in multitude. What an army. And then for the first time in the record of this campaign, we're told that they face horses and chariots. What weaponry that Israel didn't have. Now, the tribes up in this part of Canaan evidently had some skill in this matter, because repeatedly there is a reference to the chariots of the Canaanites in this particular region. And so in chapter 17 we read of the Canaanites in that area having chariots of iron and being particularly fearful enemies. We get to Judges chapter 4, and again, Jabin, another Jabin, not the same king, but perhaps a dynasty title, Jabin the king of Hazor. Again, he's famous for those chariots of iron. And so, there is a new challenge. But you know, the interesting thing is, the promise is still the same. Simple and unvarying, don't be afraid of them. I will give you the victory. There's no need to add to it, though the circumstances are new and different, and in many ways, as we've seen, new challenges facing them. It doesn't matter the fact that this word has been repeated many times already. You can trace back this promise and words very like it and almost in every situation, every battle they've faced. Back to Jericho, back even to the chapters in Deuteronomy where Moses was instructing Joshua and speaking of the battles in Canaan. It always basically boiled down to this, fear not, I'll give you the victory. I'll fight for you. I'll give them into your hand. And it doesn't matter how long it has been since this word has been given, it's still true for the people of God. Be not afraid of them, because I will give them into your hand. There is a promise of victory. In verse 8, we read that the Lord works in power according to His promise for His people. The Lord delivered them into the hand of Israel, who smote them and chased them unto great Zidon. Again, there's a familiar landmark in the region up in the north and the northwest of Canaan. The Lord delivered them into their hand. God worked. Just as easily as that, God put it into their hand. Just as you might pick something up and put it into someone's hand for them to carry away. And no matter how strong we are, there's a limit to what we can carry in our hand. It's usually not a great deal. But the Lord delivered them into the hand of Israel. A huge army. But here, there it is, just a handful. Just a handful. As far as God and His people were concerned. From one perspective, like the sand of the seashore and the multitude. From another, just a handful. That's all. When God works according to His promise, the enemy just becomes something that we can handle because God gave them into the hand of Israel. All the members of this alliance are conquered. Verse 10 through to 14 records the conquest of all their cities. Hazor is burned, the rest are conquered and taken over and possessed. The spoil becomes God's people's. They're enriched by this experience. More of the land becomes theirs. They enter in, as we've seen repeatedly, into a fuller, deeper, more blessed personal experience of the promised inheritance that God had given to them by covenant. God worked in power. God can still work in power. He is the same God. His promises are the same. There is an important emphasis in this chapter that you may have noticed. That God's people obtain the victory that God has promised as they obey His word. As they obey His word. Their obedience of God in this context is emphasized repeatedly. Perhaps for the reason that obedience in this situation was all the more noteworthy given the size of the enemy. Given the reputation of the enemy, obedience becomes all the more admirable. But look at the statements in the chapter. Verse 9, Joshua did unto them as the Lord bade him. Verse 7 gives us the background here. Joshua comes, all the people of war with him, and he does as the Lord bids him, verse 9. Then verse 12. He utterly destroyed them, as Moses the servant of the Lord commanded. Verse 15. As the Lord commanded Moses his servant, so did Moses command Joshua, and so did Joshua. He left nothing undone of all that the Lord commanded Moses. Now there's a remarkable statement. An emphatic statement of obedience. It was in the spirit of obedience that Israel enjoyed the victory promised to his people. That's how to obtain the promises God has given. Obey him. Obey him. We properly say that if we're going to obtain the promises, we must believe God. That's true. But faith is always active. Faith obeys God. That's how faith is evident. We know that faith shows itself by works, works of obedience. He left nothing undone of all that the Lord commanded Moses. There's his faith in action, and God fulfills the promise. So often we look at the size of the opposition, the battles that we face, and we think of the promises that God has given, and our faith fails us. We find ourselves unable to do anything. There'll never be an experience of the victory if we give up, if we stop, if we sit down. Some have the idea that on the battlefield they just sort of sit and wait there till the Lord does something. No, there's a battle to be fought. Action has to be taken. Obedience has to be seen. Keep on doing what God has said to do, and He will give the victory. No matter how futile it seems, no matter how little it seems, given the strength of the opposition, he left nothing undone. That's the call that you and I have. Don't leave anything undone. Don't leave anything undone. Keep doing what God has said to do, and he will give the victory. He's in the battle. We have used those words, the battle is the Lord's. In more ways than one, the battle is the Lord's. As we've seen tonight, he's behind the enemy. He's behind the opposition. He is sovereignly controlling and determining even the opposition that we face. We must leave nothing undone. Don't let that hinder us in our obedience of God. In verse 20, as the Lord commanded Moses, and again verse 23, according to all that the Lord said unto Moses. That's how promised victory is obtained, through obedience. Let us learn to obey God. Let us learn to do what He says. That's the secret of a victorious warfare here and in the experience of God's people today. The final thought is this. Notice that their warfare is prolonged. There was war a long time. War a long time. There is no instant possession of the land. There is no instant enjoyment of everything that God has promised to His people. We are called to a lifelong campaign of war against our spiritual enemies. When you think of the words of the Apostle Paul in 1 Corinthians chapter 15, it sets this matter in context. 1 Corinthians 15, great resurrection chapter, the verse 26. The last enemy that shall be destroyed is death. The last enemy. In other words, the battle is not over until the resurrection. It's a strange thing, but it's true that even if a saint dies and goes to heaven, the battle is not over. There's no active warfare against sin while they're in heaven. But the battle's not done yet, because their body's still on earth, defeated by death and sin. The last enemy that shall be destroyed is death. And so we say the warfare that God has called his people to is not only lifelong, but it's up until that point of our glorification, right until the point of the resurrection. Again in the same chapter, the verse 54. So when this corruptible, this mortal body shall have put on incorruptible, and again that happens at the resurrection, and this mortal shall have put on immortality, then, and only then, shall be brought to pass the saying that is written, death is swallowed up in victory. That's when the battle's over. God has called his people to a long battle. Now, we take this verse 18 in Joshua 11. Joshua made war a long time with all those kings. God had said to his people, right from the very beginning, as it were, Deuteronomy 7 and the verse 22, the Lord thy God will put out those nations before thee by little and little. Thou mayest not consume them at once, lest the beasts of the field increase upon thee. But the Lord thy God shall deliver them unto thee, and shall destroy them with a mighty destruction until they be destroyed. But it was going to be little by little. He had reasons for doing so. And so in the lives of God's people, advances in grace and in the possession of what Christ has given to us is little by little. Battle after battle after battle after battle after battle, little by little. Enemy after enemy after enemy. Even the long warfare that is referred to in the verse 18 here doesn't envisage the end of the campaign. In fact, it has a long way to go yet. If we compare verse 21, at that time came Joshua and cut off the Anakim from the mountains of from Hebron. If we compare that with the statement of Caleb, who was involved in that battle, and it's recorded in chapter 14, to verse 10, now behold, the Lord hath kept me alive, as he said, these 45 years. Put those two verses together, and you have a date for this long warfare. They've only been fighting for about 5 years at this point. 5 years on the battlefield is a long time. We get war weary. Long time. We go to chapter 13. And this is what we plan to look at next time in the will of God. Verse 1. Joshua was old and stricken in years, and the Lord said unto him, thou art old and stricken in years, and there remaineth yet very much land to be possessed. Joshua's ministry, we can use various means to calculate that his ministry lasted around 18 years. 5 years of war and still a lot longer to go. And when you get to the end of his life, there's still war. When you get to the book of Judges, there's still war against these enemies. And indeed, when you get to the time of David, and David comes to the throne as we were thinking of this morning, his first act goes up to Jerusalem and he takes Mount Zion. 2 Samuel chapter 5, verses 6 and 7, the Jebusites were still there. It was a stronghold that Israel had never conquered, even to the days of David. Now the battle goes on and on and on and on and on and on. It's something we need to recognize. The only way to inherit the promised possession of God's people is through warfare. That's the way God has purposed it. The rigors and the discipline of military life and warfare was what God purposed for Israel. Oh, there would be times of peace here and there. More often than not, it was an experience of war. In Judges chapter 3 in the verse 2, there's an interesting statement there made in this manner. The Lord left some of the nations of Canaan to prove Israel by them, even as many of Israel as had not known all the wars of Canaan. See, the next generation needed to learn something about war too, so the Lord left some of the enemies behind, only that the generations of the children of Israel might know to teach them war, at least such as before knew nothing thereof. That's why God left the Philistines all the way down through the history of Israel, why they're still there. To teach God's people war. You see, the Lord could have in one night done something like what he did later for Hezekiah and breathed on the enemy and all of them would have been gone in one night. Just gone. He could have wrecked Canaan the way he wrecked Egypt with the plagues, but he didn't. He called his people to fight and to fight and to keep fighting and he kept them on the battlefield and they left enemies so that the next generation and the next generation would learn to fight. Because it is on the battlefield that God's people come to possess their inheritance that God has covenanted to give them. It's still that way for the Christian. Called to be a good soldier of Jesus Christ. To fight a good warfare, to fight the fight of faith. To stand, having on the whole armor of God, to stand in an evil day, wrestling not against flesh and blood, but against principalities and powers, against spiritual wickedness in high places. God has called his people to fight. Because that is the environment in which we come to enjoy the experience of victory and possession of that which he has covenanted to give us. We need to recognize, as Joshua and his people recognized, the war is long. It's not over in a day or two or even a year or two. It's a long warfare. It's a lifelong battle. There's a form of the verb to multiply is used here. He made war a long time. Multiple battles over multiplied days, multiplied years. Let us not grow weary in well doing. We do. We have a tendency to it. But let us, as we grow weary, encourage ourselves again in the Lord. God is in this. This battle is of the Lord. He has called me to fight it. This is the only way for me to experience the blessing of my inheritance in Christ on the earth. And it'll be a battle I have to fight to my dying breath. And it'll be a battle that I'll not fully be delivered from and discharged from until the resurrection when the last enemy that will be destroyed is death. May God give us the patience and the eye of faith to recognize the truth that is set out for us in these verses. God is at work. We must obey. Trust his promise to give the victory.